providing online shopping to citizens under lockdown. Yet the success of these companies are not translated into better wages and better safety conditions for their employees. We're prepared for you an article written by Asoka Bandaraj. The piece is titled Pandemic, the so-called Great Reset and Resistance. The article has been taken from the front page of the Asia Times website. Please stay with us for more of Asoka Bandaraj's article. According to the latest International Labour Organization reports, as job losses escalate due to coronavirus lockdowns aimed at slowing the spread of COVID-19, nearly half of the global workforce is at risk of losing their livelihood, access to food, and the ability to survive. The World Economic Forum, WEF, has stated, with some 2.6 billion people around the world in some kind of lockdown, we are conducting arguably the largest psychological experiment ever. Dominant global political and economic institutions and the media present their pandemic narratives as based on scientific authority. However, there is increasing disagreement on the origin and prevention of the virus within the biomedical profession. Many doctors and physicians and scientists are questioning whether COVID-19 is a natural occurrence or the product of a leak from a laboratory experimenting with coronaviruses and biological weaponry. There is concern over the accuracy of PCR, polymerase chain reaction tests, and false positives, as well as the classification of deaths simply caused by COVID-19, when an overwhelming number of fatalities are related to pre-existing illnesses or comorbidities, such as diabetes and heart disease. Even according to statistics released recently by the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, COVID-19 was mentioned as the sole cause of death in only 6% of the cases. For example, the disproportionately higher rates of COVID deaths among Native Americans and Alaska Inuit are due to their higher rates of obesity, higher rates of diabetes, asthma, and heart disease than among more privileged U.S. communities. As suggested by the members of the World Economic Forum, WEF, the COVID pandemic has exacerbated existing inequalities along gender, race, and economic class divides across the world. According to a study by the Institute for Policy Studies, just as unemployed and uninsured Americans are pleading for support, the combined wealth of U.S. billionaires surpassed $1 trillion in gains since March 2020, at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The top five U.S. billionaires, that is Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Warren Buffett, and Larry Ellison, saw their wealth grow by a total of $101.7 billion. Or 26% during this period. Among the pandemic profiteers are chief executives of companies like Zoom and Skype, providing video conferencing, and Amazon, providing online shopping to citizens under lockdown. Yet the success of these companies has not translated into better wages and better safety conditions for their employees. However, the political and ideological power of the billionaire class and their influence over domestic and global policymaking are increasing. Relevant in this regard is billionaire Bill Gates' role in the development and marketing of vaccines, and interest in use of vaccines as a method of population control. The pharmaceutical industry, that is Big Pharma, including vaccine manufacturers, are known for inflating prices, avoiding paying of taxes, and manipulating the political process to maximize their profits. Unfortunately, this corrupt industry is a key player in the race to supposedly end the COVID-19 pandemic. The incoming Joe Biden administration, who projected by the media as the winner of the U.S. 2020 presidential election, has received extensive funding from the pharmaceutical industry, yet it has not agreed to cut the cost of a possible coronavirus vaccine developed with federal research dollars. Rather, the Biden administration, also heavily funded by the big technology firms, finance and defense sectors, is poised to facilitate the so-called Great Reset, a World Economic Forum initiative to remake the post-pandemic world order. The World Economic Forum, which identifies itself as the International Organization for Public-Private Partnership, that is, like the Council on Foreign Relations, a geopolitical corporate power agency, sees the social and economic devastation caused by the COVID-19 pandemic as a purported unique window of opportunity to shape the recovery. Speaking at a conference organized by the World Economic Forum in June, former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry claimed, "Forces and pressures that were pushing us into crisis over the social contact are now exacerbated. The world is coming apart dangerously in terms of global institutions and leadership." The so-called Great Reset, envisaged by the World Economic Forum, seeks to address these challenges through radical global restructuring. It seeks to reinvent the priorities of societies, the nature of business models, and the management of a global commons to supposedly build a new social contract, with the purported sustainable development and resilience as its ultimate objectives. At its next annual gathering of the rich and powerful in Davos, Switzerland, in January of 2021, the World Economic Forum is expected to adopt the so-called Great Reset and also incorporate youth leaders from around the world into the initiative through a virtual summit. But many are questioning the true objectives of both the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset. For example, a pandemic simulation called Event 201 was conducted in October of 2019, about 3 months before the COVID-19 outbreak, by the World Economic Forum, WEF, in conjunction with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The simulation predicted up to 65 million deaths due to a coronavirus outbreak. Many are wondering why these purported powerful organizations, having apparently already run the exact scenario as a test, failed to prevent or at least to prepare the world for the imminent viral breakout. Global political economy has been moving in the direction of increasing technological and market integration through social media, artificial intelligence, and biotechnology. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, the trends towards digitization and commoditization of economic and social relations have increased. The so-called Great Reset seeks to accelerate and solidify these trends, as well as expand corporate control of natural resources and state surveillance of individuals. In the post-pandemic Great Reset, there would not be much life left outside the technological corporate nexus, dominated by monolithic agribusinesses, pharmaceutical giants, communication giants, defense and other interconnected corporations, and the governments and media serving them. The proponents of the Great Reset envisage a so-called new world, where you will own nothing, and you will be supposedly happy. Whatever you want, you will rent, and it will be delivered by drones. But it is more likely that this revolution will make the vast majority of humanity a powerless appendage of technology, with little consciousness and meaning in their lives. The mainstream media establishment tends to cast all critiques of the dominant COVID narrative and solutions as conspiracy theories. Yet more and more people are questioning the narrative of the origin and management of the coronavirus pandemic, and instead see the need to shift to a truly democratic, just and ecological civilization. Many of the anti-lockdown protesters around the world have had limited focus on social restrictions and personal freedom, desires usually in tune with the individualism of globalized consumer culture. Whilst these have gained some attention in the mainstream media, the more focused and progressive demands for social and economic rights by civil society groups have received scant attention. These include demands by numerous groups to make COVID-19 medicines and vaccines free and fair for all. There is also a demand for a global public inquiry to be led by independent scientists to gather evidence on the origin and the evolution of COVID-19. In addition, there is a call for an international biological warfare crimes tribunal to bring perpetrators of the pandemic to justice, whether they be from the United States or anywhere else in the world. The overall objective of these demands is greater transparency, greater ethics and accountability in the use of technology, especially biotechnology and vaccines against COVID-19 and other viruses. The demand for enforcement of the Biological Weapons Convention, BWC, calls on the nations of the world, China, Russia, the United States, to come together to enforce better verification systems for preventing the production of biological weapons in the future, before the world is put through multiple pandemics to come. These are concerns to be included in an alternative, ethical, wise and compassionate strategy. The COVID-19 pandemic is a turning point, an opportunity to change. The reset we need now is not the creation of a post-human, post-nature world defined by unregulated corporate-led growth of artificial intelligence and biotechnology. We need to balance digitization and commoditization with an ecological reset, a way of living that respects the environment, promotes agroecology, promotes bioregionalism and local communities. We need to raise our consciousness and understanding of humanity as a species in nature. We need to raise our connectedness to one another and the rest of planetary life.
Economic divide.
It's known as an immigrant-friendly country, and it is America's neighbor to the north. It may have a charismatic prime minister to some, but what lies beneath the surface is our focus. That country, Canada, like many economies around the world, ravaged by COVID-19 pandemic. Here's the PM Trudeau with his stimulus plan announced back in March.
In these extraordinary times, our government is taking extraordinary measures. The measures we're announcing today will provide up to $27 billion in direct support to Canadian workers and businesses, plus $55 billion to meet liquidity needs of Canadian businesses and households through tax deferrals to help stabilize the economy.
Well, yet at that point that you heard, the depth of the problem was really not known. As it progressed, it got worse. for example, Montreal, stripped of the crowds of visitors that usually flock to its sites, to the Grand Prix, to its renowned festivals. Many businesses across the board in Canada were suffering, as you're about to see. Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Hawaii. In this week's episode, we will take a look at Canada's economy and some of its weak points, like income inequality, and how the impact of COVID-19 has had on that economy. Now down to some basic facts about how battered Canada's economy is. In late October, the governor of the Central Bank of Canada forecast that the economy would not fully recover until sometime in the year 2023. Of course, you need to keep in mind whether a vaccine will come along that would accelerate the pace of the recovery, which at this point, that may have already happened. On the other hand, if the economy weakens amid a second wave of infections, the central bank could, if necessary, cut the already record low interest rates. But will that help people spend money? That's the real question, isn't it? But this message from Prime Minister Trudeau was a reality check on how bad the COVID-19 situation actually is in Canada, something which obviously the government did not anticipate.
Canada has often been seen as a safe haven for immigrants, a multicultural and multinational country, which is actually a combination of indigenous First Nations and waves of immigrants. But when it comes to equality, there seems to be a huge difference between white Canadians and non-whites. One of the major differences is the income gap. At the moment, Canada's income gap is at a record high. Experts say that there are two factors contributing to this growing gap: a widening disparity in labor earnings between high and low-paid workers, and less redistribution. Taxes and benefits also reduce inequality, less in Canada than in most countries.
When it comes to native people, well, like the Palestinians in Western Asia, you know, native people are indigenous to this territory, and this territory has been taken, in some cases, you know, violently and ruthlessly from the indigenous peoples, and they were pushed out of even citizenship. So the, you know, there's been a great theft of resources and wealth from the indigenous peoples, and it's been devastating in its effect on people's psychology, their ability to adapt to the current economy.
How bad is Canada's economy doing anyways? Maybe the question should be, prior to the COVID-19, was it underperforming? Well, don't take our word for it. Let's look at the Bank of Canada and what it has done. First, it has said that Canada's financial system is resilient. Yet a closer look reveals that there are high levels of household debt. And you guessed it, money that the bank has lent to households. Now, the central bank has also said that the longer the pandemic affects jobs and incomes, the greater the risk of financial trouble for households and businesses. Basically, that's another way of saying that risks to households, businesses, and markets actually remain. When it comes to businesses, the usual ones are the victims, like businesses in other countries across the world, including transportation, arts and entertainment, for example, accommodation, and food services. Now it's time to look at what has affected Canada's neighbor, the U.S., severely. Food insecurity.
Food insecurity is yet another challenge people in less privileged communities face in Canada. As some food banks are forced to close, daycares and schools close also, and paychecks stop. And people of all ages and backgrounds may face food insecurities. For those who were already food insecure, the situation is worse. A meal, let alone a nutritious meal, may not be accessible.
Disparities in the cost of living in different areas. It's very expensive to live in the Toronto area. It would be less expensive to live in, say, Regina. So the issue of a minimal wage, this is important. We see a growing poverty. We see poverty in Canada largely along the lines of, you know, native people are at an extreme disadvantage in the economy.
Canada's minority groups, including the indigenous populations, are now facing greater challenges. For example, overcrowding in housing makes social distancing, self-isolation, or quarantining an issue.
Far more heavily incarcerated. They go to jail at a much higher rate than blacks in the United States.
In northern remote isolated and urban indigenous communities, there may be 10 people living in a space designed for two or three. Housing in disrepair also serves to support transmission of respiratory illnesses.
The resource-based economy, especially oil and gas. Oil and gas is very difficult. The price of oil and gas is very low. And there's been a great emphasis on building pipelines from the Alberta tar sands across the mountains so that the bitumen can be shipped to China.
Okay, today we have a special guest joining us for this edition of the program. His name, Robert Hux. He's a spokesman for the Committee for the Republic of Canada, Canada Liaison for Schiller Institute. He was also a contributor to the Canadian Patriot, News from the Northern Front, the edition which focused on Canada's struggle for nationhood and the Round Table movement. Robert Hux, welcome to Economic Divide. First question, before the pandemic, Canada's economic indicators, they weren't that great, and now the pandemic has obviously affected the economy severely. The real GDP, according to one report, has fallen 18% in the 2 months, which none of the other four recessions actually even came close. Is that how bad Canada's economy is doing at this point?
Yes, well, what you're describing is this is not particular to Canada. All of the G7 countries were hit quite hard by the pandemic. Now, I think the question that should be asked is why were certain Asian countries, and particularly why was China able to deal with this pandemic so much better than the G7 nations, for example? Because this, you know, in late December of 2019 was a disease that was not clearly defined what it was. Very rapidly, China took the emergency measures so that that by the end of February, they had using public health measures and a huge mobilization, they had gotten the pandemic under control.
In terms of Canada's wages, there have been doubts that it has actually led to income inequality. Are Canadians not earning enough to actually cover their expenses? For example, Canada's rate per hour wage is $13.01, yet in Ontario, the rate is calculated to be at least $15.40 per hour.
Well, first off, the late economist Lyndon LaRouche emphasized that the only competent approach to economics is from the standpoint of what he calls physical economics. And in physical economics, you do not take as primary money. You do not take as primary even, for example, a factory producing X number of million tons of widgets per year. What you take as primary is the entire national economy, and on the larger scale, the entire world. And the question that that a physical economist has to answer is what are the measures that have to be taken by, for example, the government of my country in collaboration with the government of other countries around the world to ensure that 50 years from now, mankind is positioned to be able to meet the challenges that we will surely meet. Publication put out by Lyndon LaRouche's associates called the Executive Intelligence Review produced a special report in at the end of May of this year entitled The LaRouche Program to Reopen the Economy. The world needs 1.5 billion productive jobs. And it said if you take the figures that was that have been provided by the International Labor Organization, using figures from 2019, the world population is about 7.7 billion people. The labor force of the world is roughly 3.5 billion people. Now, if you look at the number of those 3.5 billion people who are employed in what's called formal jobs, formal employment, and the you add to that the number of people that are employed in the informal economy, you're looking at roughly then beyond that the number of people that are unemployed, and a fourth category, the number of people who might get a paycheck or might be collecting money, but are not doing anything of productive value for their nation or the world. For example, people selling cigarettes on a street corner, or what they call in the United States or Canada the gig economy. This could even include things such as hotels, restaurants, things that are not physically productive. And by productive, Mr. LaRouche means the production of the food, the raw materials, the intermediate goods required to physically reproduce the ability to maintain the existing human population and allow for growth.
Final question, poverty, another economic indicator that's not going the right direction for Canada. February 2020, a report has said that the 2018 income tax return saying that 3.2 million Canadians were living below the poverty line, discrimination and systemic inequality rather than the lack of or poor individual choice to be the main reasons. Why is this the case, especially among the Indigenous, the visible minority, immigrants, and single-parent families?
Well, first off, as I said, you have to sort of look at this from a higher standpoint. One of the things that began occurring from the 1971 takedown of the Bretton Woods system on was the development at a later point of these free trade agreements, such as the North American Free Trade Act. Our organization put out a special report at that time entitled Auschwitz Below the Border, referring to the U.S.-Mexican border. Because you were essentially, creating conditions where people who were working in the United States at a certain higher wage associated with a skilled trade, these jobs, fled to Mexico or eventually other places, including China at one point. Based on this idea, which is a British outlook of economics, the way to get wealthy, according to the British imperial outlook, is to buy something cheap and sell it very expensively. And if you control finance, if you can control transportation networks and so forth, that's the way that you supposedly get wealthy. But that precisely is the model that is now broken down. The coronavirus pandemic just exposed the underlying dysfunction of the entire world economy because of that. And so I think that we should be, if we were prepared to work with China, look at what they have actually done. Just recently, China has announced that the last remains of extreme poverty in China have now been eliminated. It's not that people are not poor in China, because they're talking about absolute poverty. But how did they do this? They did this through, in some cases, if people are living in mountainous, remote regions, it's very difficult to deal with the situation. They would move them to an area where they could get productive employment. And Canada, as well as the United States, could learn some lessons from that kind of approach.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much for that. Robert Hux, the spokesman for the Committee for the Republic of Canada. All right, it's time for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up in the next half of the program. Current Affairs and Impact Analyst Mon Abedin will be joining us. He will share with us some posts such as wealth tax. Could that be the answer to Canada's economic woes? Also look at how employment losses were greater for younger, low-wage, and non-unionized workers in Canada. And finally, a look at gender gap in the next half, and surprisingly how race plays an important role in income inequality. Hello, welcome back to Economic Divide. This is our in-depth section. When it comes to income inequality, the basic question we are asking is Canada becoming more unequal? We're going to set out the three findings that we came up with. First is income inequality to have increased over the past 20 years. Second, richest group increased its share of total national income, while the poorest group lost its share. And finally, we're going to take a look at how Canadians in the poorest income group still saw their income levels rise, albeit minimally. Okay, now, the report titled The Affordability Education, written in 2019, discusses the rising concern about how the cost of living in Canada and how it presents a threat and opportunity to progressives, a report commissioned by the Broadbent Institute. Going on to what we thought was important here, you can see one in four Canadians cite financial issues, taxes, or housing as the thing keeping them up at night. Moving on to the next, cost of living, housing affordability, wages, inequality, and taxes. Well, these are things that are actually vote drivers. 57% rank an issue tied to the cost of living, wages, or taxes as their top issues. Moving on to the next finding that we have here, almost half of Canadians are worried about their cost of living. It's broken it down, asking a question how worried Canadians are, and it says women are more worried than men. Concern crosses all age groups, however, and that worry is directly related to household income. So we can see how household income obviously has an effect when it comes to the economy. And here, again, cost of living, in terms of how worried Canadians are about it, it's broken it down to the level of income from 35,000 moving upwards, 35 to 50, 50 to 75, all the way up to 150,000 K. And of course, you can see the trend that exists here. And what this means is that, well, Canadians are worried about their cost of living. They want to have enough income to pay for things that they want in life, things such as rent, such as everyday costs. While most Canadians feel that their cost of living and income inequality has gotten worse over the past few years, they don't think that corporate profits have been hurt. In fact, 73% believe that corporate profits have actually improved or stayed about the same over the past few years.
The economic pain in Canada has not been evenly distributed. In a report published by four Canadian economists, it was revealed that employment losses were greater for younger, low-wage, and non-unionized workers, with public-facing sectors like retail and restaurants to have been hit the hardest. Previous analyses have shown that women are being disproportionately affected. The report showed that the labor market impact of the COVID-19 pandemic has been harsher on those workers who hold the least bargaining power.
Freefall, and it's largely created by government forcing on the public lockdowns, locking down our societies, our businesses. People can't go out to eat, can't do the usual things. It seems it's being purposely done according to some agenda that seeks to destroy the economy.
Time now to bring in Mahan Abedin. He is our current affairs and impact analyst who joins us in the studios. Mahan, welcome.
Thank you. So
you have some posts that you want to share with us?
Absolutely, and they are focused on Canada. Of course, Canada is struggling with pretty much the same financial woes that much of the Western world is grappling with, including the U.S. So here, focus on progressive wealth tax would provide that amount of funds to fight wealth inequality. Again, sounds very good in theory, but how practical are these plans? We all know that tax regimes are very hard to design and even harder to implement. So yeah, this tweet strikes me with being made with very good intentions. I'm just not sure how practical it is.
Well, it shows how important inequality overall and wealth inequality in particular is.
Sure.
When they're thinking about a wealth tax.
Well, you know, with Canada, it's always framed as this progressive country in North America, especially in relation to the U.S. But in reality, it's suffering from, broadly speaking, the same structural, financial, fiscal issues as the U.S. is, but on a much smaller scale, obviously,
sure,
given its size. So there's hardly anything progressive about Canada from a financial point of view.
Okay, let's move on to the next screen here.
Sure. So, impact of the pandemic, again, similar issues we see in America, foreign workers, immigrants, refugees, international students. This shows you the problems Canada is grappling with, but it doesn't really give you any solutions.
It's hard to look at this and not think about whether this might be also pointing towards the fact that perhaps there's discrimination when it comes to foreign workers, immigrants,
yes.
refugees, and international.
Again, that goes back to the heart of what I said earlier. Canada is often projected as this progressive place, but in reality, it's replete with racism, discrimination, as the U.S. is, right? So, you know.
Okay, the last tweet that you have for
us. Sure. So, this is coming from Maxime Bernier. This is coming from a different angle now, basically a right-wing angle, accusing others of being, you know, left-wing politicos, that, you know, their job is not to fight inequalities, to save the Canadian dollar. To me, this speaks of the very hard battles so-called Canadian progressive have in terms of reforming their country's financial fiscal system. They're grappling with that kind of mentality, which is a very American one. It's kind of right-wing in fiscal terms, super capitalism, free markets, and most important of all, low taxation.
That's right. Thank you so much for that.
You're
we
welcome.
Always appreciate your
Thank
input.
You.
Mohan Abedin, our current affairs and impact analyst. Okay, our next focus is the gender gap and how race plays a factor in income inequality in Canada. Do stay with us.
The culture of inequality continues to persist in Canada's capital market sector, and the brunt of it is felt by women and people who are racialized, Indigenous, or other minority groups. According to a study of 600 Canadian finance workers conducted by Women in Capital Markets in 2019, only half of women believe that they were treated equally and to have the same access to opportunities as other genders at their firm, and just a third thought their company is free from gender bias, that the promotion process was fair and objective. The study revealed that black women were the least likely to say that they were treated equally by their firm and manager, and the least likely to perceive that they have equal career opportunities.
Canada's economy has been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic. That much is definitely known. But the current problems are also an outcome of poor economic policies from the past. We need to mention the First Nation people and how their rights have been violated, along with how they have been deprived of reaping the benefits of what the Canadian economy has to offer. What has Canada done for them recently? And finally, Canada needs to address its inequality issues soon in order to not have this be another virus on top of the coronavirus that has plagued its people and society. That's all the time we have for this week's episode. We hope you've enjoyed the show. On behalf of myself, Kevin Halfway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
For a man obsessed with winning, Donald Trump is losing a lot. In the months since the election, the president and his legal team have come no closer in their frantic efforts to overturn the result, notching up dozens of losses in law courts across the country, with more rolling by the day. According to an Associated Press tally, of roughly 50 cases brought by Donald Trump's campaign and his allies, more than 30 have been rejected or dropped, and about a dozen are awaiting action. The advocacy group Democracy Docket put Trump's losses even higher, tweeting on Friday, 4th of December, that Donald Trump's team has lost 46 post-election lawsuits following several fresh losses in several states on Friday. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Trump's Latest Batch of Election Lawsuits Fizzle as Dozens of Losses Pile Up. Stay with us for more of The Guardian's article. For a man obsessed with winning, Donald Trump is losing a lot. In the months since the election, the president and his legal team have come no closer in their frantic efforts to overturn the result, notching up dozens of losses in law courts across the country, with more rolling in by the day. According to an Associated Press tally of roughly 50 cases brought by Trump's campaign and his allies, more than 30 have been rejected or dropped, and about a dozen awaiting action. The advocacy group Democracy Docket put Donald Trump's losses even higher, tweeting on Friday that Trump's team had lost 46 post-election lawsuits, following several fresh losses in several states on Friday, 4th of December. Trump has notched just one small victory, a case challenging a decision to move the deadline to provide missing proof of identification for certain absentee ballots and mail-in ballots in Pennsylvania. Five more losses came on Friday, 4th of December. The Trump campaign lost its bid to overturn the results of the election in Nevada and in Michigan, and a Michigan appeals court rejected a case from his campaign. The Minnesota Supreme Court dismissed a challenge brought by GOP lawmakers, and in Arizona, a judge threw out a bid to undo Joe Biden's victory there, concluding that the state's Republican Party chairwoman failed to prove fraud or misconduct and that the evidence presented at trial wouldn't reverse Donald Trump's loss. The Wisconsin Supreme Court also declined to hear a lawsuit brought by a conservative group over Trump's loss. Donald Trump's latest failings came as California certified Joe Biden as the official winner in the state, officially handing him the Electoral College majority needed to win the White House. Secretary of State Alex Padilla's formal approval of the state's 55 pledged electors brought Joe Biden's tally so far to 279, according to accounts by the Associated Press, just over the 270 threshold needed for victory. The Republican president and his allies continue to mount new cases, recycling the same baseless claims even after Trump's own Attorney General William Barr declared this week that the Justice Department had uncovered no evidence of widespread fraud. This will continue to be a losing strategy, and in a way it's even bad for him. He gets to re-lose the election numerous times, said Kent Greenfield, a professor at Boston College Law School. The depths of his petulance and narcissism continue to surprise me. President Trump has refused to admit he lost the election and this week posted a 46-minute speech to Facebook filled with conspiracy theories, misstatements, and vows to keep up his fight to subvert the election. Judges in battleground states have repeatedly swatted down legal challenges brought by President Trump and his allies. Trump's legal team has vowed to take one Pennsylvania case to the U.S. Supreme Court, even though it was rejected in a scathing ruling by a federal judge, as well as by an appeals court. After recently being kicked off Trump's legal team, the conservative attorney, Sidney Powell, filed new lawsuits in Arizona and Wisconsin this week, riddled with errors and wild conspiracy claims about election rigging. One of the plaintiffs named in the Wisconsin case said he never agreed to participate in the case and found out through social media that he had been included. In his video posted on Wednesday, Donald Trump falsely claimed there were facts and evidence of a mass conspiracy created by Democrats to steal the election. A similar argument made by his lawyer Rudy Giuliani and others before judges, which have been largely unsuccessful. Most of their claims are rooted in conspiracy theories about voting machines, as well as testimony from partisan poll watchers who claimed they didn't get close enough to see ballots being tallied because of COVID-19 safety precautions. "No, I didn't hear any facts or evidence," tweeted the Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, a Democrat, after watching the video on Wednesday night. "What I did hear was a sad Facebook rant from a man who lost an election."
It seems that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the development and administration of a vaccine against the COVID-19 virus, with multiple research centres finally in the latter stages of producing a viable and effective vaccine against the virus. However, while so close to the end, is the decision by the British to roll out the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine a little too soon. Already the British and the US have been arguing about the timing of the promise by the British government to start inoculating the most vulnerable groups of people in the UK by as early as this coming Monday, with the US criticising the British either due to the early release of a yet untested product, or maybe through jealousy of being pipped to the post by the Brits, with the UK having the worst rates in Europe, with already 60,000 people dead from the virus. The US is also in a difficult situation, with around 1,500 people dying each day, and already 276,000 people having succumbed to the coronavirus in America. Embarrassing figures for the outgoing President of the United States, who would have no doubt enjoyed being the first to distribute the vaccine. So why then are the British and Americans fighting over the issue? With the British choosing to start with the order of 40 million Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines, it seems odd that they have chosen a vaccine developed outside of the UK. Yet when one examines the effectiveness of the vaccines available, the British version, developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, is only around 62% effective. Hence maybe why the British have rushed ahead with the German-US version, quicker than the Americans and the Germans themselves. So could the tension then come from the attitude of the British when it comes to wanting to get the vaccine out as quickly as possible, rushing it through the regulators at such a pace? British Education Minister Gavin Williamson clearly flared tempers with his attitude towards the US and the EU when he stated that British regulators were obviously better, and then going one step further, saying the whole of the UK was better than the US and the EU. Clearly a diplomatic flop by publicly stating such words. What now remains to be seen is A, just how realistic the monumental task of distributing a vaccine that needs to be kept at minus 70 degrees will be, and B, will the US show any sympathy towards the UK should the process fail, and as Britain comes crashing out of the EU, looking at the US for a future trade deal. Britain is against the ropes when it comes to the Brexit negotiations with the EU. However, the announcement that the British will have the vaccine out on Monday is something that the British negotiating team will secretly be proud of as talks reach a stalemate in London. But the EU, with all its red tape, bureaucracy and processes, has yet to fully approve any developed vaccine so far and has taken the opportunity to criticise the UK for a hasty decision when it comes to announcing the vaccine will be available to various groups within Britain. Until the European Medicines Agency approves the vaccine, the rest of the continent will have to remain patient. However, there are arguments that the EMA is more rigorous than the British, leading the Germans to label the move by the British as problematic. But the UK may have one valid point when it comes to the rollout. If the vaccine is truly over 95% effective and it can save lives, Then what's wrong with the British taking such a step? With the British finding themselves stuck in a desperate situation when it comes to agreeing a deal with the EU in the post-Brexit era, and time fast running out before the deadline approaches to switch to WTO rules, could then the decision by the British to start distribution be a final dig at the EU and prove that by no longer being part of the bloc, it can take such decisions without fallout that would have emerged from Brussels should they still have been members? But the truth of the matter is simple. This is one of the world's worst cases of a global pandemic, at least in modern times, and the economic impact, as well as the devastating cost of life, has left a scar and legacy that will never be forgotten. So whether it be Pfizer-BioNTech, AstraZeneca, Moderna, or Gamaleya, and whether it's the UK, the US, or the EU, or in fact any other country that starts the vaccine first, at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian issue, and when the time comes, the whole world will need the doses eventually.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have managed to flee Myanmar's northwestern state of Rakhine, where they repeatedly came under attack by the army and extremist Buddhists. Many of these refugees have come to Bangladesh over the past years. They have largely been camped in the southern district of Cox's Bazar in overcrowded camps and in squalid conditions. This week, Bangladeshi authorities began moving Rohingya families from the camps near the Myanmar border without their consent. Bangladeshi police escort the refugees in buses to a port and then to this island. Bisanchar is their destination, a flood-prone island vulnerable to frequent cyclones. The remote island, the Bay of Bengal, emerged from the sea 20 years ago. The government of Bangladesh says it has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a small city there with mosques and red-roofed apartment blocks. It says the relocation will ease chronic overcrowding in camps at Cox's Bazar. But the refugees are unwilling to set foot on the remote island. There are many concerns about the conditions of the brand new settlement. For instance, distance from the mainland will make it very difficult to reach the refugees in emergencies. Meanwhile, hundreds of Rohingya who were sent to the island in April after being picked up at sea don't want to remain there. They have accused settlement guards of sexual assault. Bangladeshi authorities have not allowed the United Nations or rights groups to monitor their relocation.
It really raises the question, what is Bangladesh hiding if, you know, it has gone to such controversial length to decline offer, consistently offered by the United Nations agencies and UN itself to do basic safety assessment of the island.
Rights groups want Bangladesh to halt the controversial move immediately. Rohingya Muslims are recognized by the UN as the world's worst persecuted minority group. In January, the United Nations highest court ordered Buddhist majority Myanmar to prevent genocidal violence against its Rohingya Muslim minority and preserve evidence of past attacks. The International Court of Justice instructed the Asian country to respect the requirements of the 1948 Genocide Convention. The ICJ warned that nearly 600,000 Rohingya Muslims who are still in Myanmar are, quote, extremely vulnerable to violence at the hands of the military. But since the ICJ ruling, little has really changed. Human rights lawyers and activists said recently that Myanmar is continuing to commit genocide against Rohingya Muslims in violation of orders by the UN's top court. The ongoing crisis has left the international reputation of Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, in tatters. Suu Kyi has defended the actions of the army and is unwilling to change her stance. Many rights groups and Rohingya activists have been demanding that she be stripped of her Nobel Peace Prize. But so far, no meaningful action has been taken against her or the military.
Myanmar government has not really been put under any type of concerted pressure, you know, not by the United States, not by the European Union, not by British government, not certainly not by China or India or Japan.
Powerful states have considerable trade ties with Myanmar. They can easily use their economic leverage to force change in Myanmar's behavior, but they have chosen not to exert pressure on the country over the plight of the minority group.
It seems that even when Britain is down on its knees, it receives yet another kick in the teeth to make sure it won't get up again. The acclaimed and once respected British retail industry has seen two of its super heavyweights each receive a knockout blow to go with the rest of the nation, as both have collapsed dramatically within a day of each other. After 242 years of trading on the British High Street, what started off as a single store in London, well-known brand Debenhams has collapsed, putting at risk thousands of jobs and seeing 124 stores set to close for good, leaving a significant gap in the retail areas of the UK. Joining Debenhams and collapsing just the day before is the Arcadia Group, which owns the likes of Topshop, Burton, Dorothy Perkins and Evans, and will see 13,000 employees looking for work as Christmas approaches and a grim year comes to an end.
What all retailers need to understand, and some do it better than others, is that we need to have a reason to visit their stores. So I think as one of the lessons from this, although sadly for the workforce at Arcadia that might not apply so much, but for the industry one of the lessons is that your store estate has got to be great. It's got to inspire, it's got to excite, and it's got to draw people in.
Between Debenhams and Arcadia, some 25,000 people will now join the unemployment figures that Britain is already suffering with. And alarmingly, with the majority of staff in the retail sector fairly unskilled, the prospects of a new job are far from a reality. Yet it's not just the retail sector that has suffered in Britain, with many other industries and big names collapsing in 2020, in part due to the COVID-19 virus, but also thanks to the disastrous handling of Brexit, which has seen many low-skilled workers flee the UK into richer European markets, leaving a gap in the labour market that's simply not being filled by the British. What now remains to be seen is whether the introduction of the upcoming vaccine created by Pfizer and BioNTech, which has just been approved by the British government, will come in time to save the other few remaining retail outlets that are hanging on by a thread as Brexit fast approaches, the COVID-19 pandemic peaks at its second wave, and the people in institutions of Britain are left on a knife edge as uncertainty reigns over the country. The next 36 hours will be crucial as Michel Barnier continues to work around the clock to put pressure on the British negotiating team to accept the terms and conditions being imposed by the EU. With Barnier in constant liaison with the 27 remaining EU states as to the progress of the talks, of which he holds the power of attorney on behalf of the EU. Yet in spite of multiple rounds of talks, Barnier remains far from optimistic that a deal can be done, and has warned the EU nations to face the very real prospect that Britain will leave the EU with no deal, leaving trade and commerce to continue under WTO rules, which will no doubt be far more painful for Britain than it will for the EU. Many EU nations have stated that they support Barnier and are insisting that he remain tough to the end, suggesting that under no circumstances should he compromise with the British to allow a deal to go through, unless it fully benefits the EU, with France leading the resistance and seeing backing from many other European superpowers.
Und ich wünsche Michel Barnier und gegebenenfalls auch Ursula von der Leyen viel Kraft und viel Geschick für die letzten Verhandlungsschritte. Wir brauchen aber auch kein Abkommen um jeden Preis. Das haben wir deutlich gemacht. Wir wollen eins, aber wir werden sonst auch Maßnahmen ergreifen, die notwendig sind. Auf jeden Fall liegt ein Abkommen im Interesse aller.
So clear is the obvious lack of leadership displayed by the British negotiating team and the Conservative government of Boris Johnson, who so eagerly fought for Brexit, that the people of Britain are also waking up to the reality of the impact of Brexit, such as the collapse of the British retail industry, with many in Britain now showing signs that they're worried about what the future may hold for the tiny island nation. What is guaranteed is that Britain can no longer put all the blame on the COVID-19 virus for its disastrous year, and must now finally acknowledge that without the EU powerhouse to prop it up, Britain is weak and is falling faster than a house of cards. Death to America and Israel. with the Iranian lawmakers chanting condemnation of the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist. The day started with the passing of a draft bill at Iran's parliament. This was the first retaliation by Iran after the assassination of the Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The provisions that were passed, which still need to be approved before turning into law, were the backbone of the JCPOA. Hard-fought in negotiations between Iran and the world powers, some of the provisions that were passed by Iran's parliament include the enrichment